Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I'm Matt.
And today we're discussing getting rich slowly and dealing with money anxiety with JD Roth.
Yeah, Joel, today's guest is personal finance writer JD Roth, who started his blog Get Rich Slowly in the early years of the internet, right? This is back in 2006.
Well, that's a long time ago.
I think Facebook had just launched as well, so it was JD and Mark.
Two heavy hitters early on.
But it's grown to be one of the most well-respected personal finance sites around, thanks to his superb writing and his desire to serve his readers. Oh, and he's also a huge Taylor Swift fan. That's important. JD, does that make you a Swiftie?
It does make me a Swiftie.
I didn't know if you were that committed, but I'm glad to hear you are. But thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today, man.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh, JD, we're so glad to have you today. Seriously, yeah, your site's been around a long time and it's helped so many people. And there's a lot of wisdom in there that we can't wait to kind of unpack and get out of your brain for our listeners today on the show. And by the way, JD, every week on the show, we drink a beer, a craft beer, because Matt and I, for us, it's really important to prioritize the here and now, prioritize something that we value today while we're trying to be intentional and save for the future. So our first question to every guest is, what's your splurge? What is JD Roth's craft beer equivalent?
Well, it might be craft beer.
Oh, that's, we love to
no,
hear that.
I actually have a better answer, but I was drinking a local, I live in Portland, Oregon. Portland, Oregon has a lot of craft beer.
Yes, you do.
So I was just drinking some craft beer earlier, although right now I'm drinking my favorite Scotch whiskey. 10-year Ardbeg. I love that stuff.
Oh, man.
Matt's a big Scotch fan too, by the way, so you guys can totally
Excellent.
Learn out on that.
I've got a
Excellent.
Bottle of Ardbeg literally just over to my right on the shelf.
And I don't generally drink it at 5:23 in the evening, which is what time I am recording this podcast, but I am drinking it at 5:23 in the evening right now. No, my big splurge, I would say season tickets for the Portland Timbers Major League Soccer team. I'm a huge fan. I've been a fan for, oh my gosh, do I have to do the math? 44 years? So.
And I know season tickets, you actually wrote about this at one point on your site, or I heard you talk about it somewhere. We knew that you love soccer, and Matt and I were huge soccer fans too. We actually moved the interview tonight. We asked you, and we knew you would understand as a huge soccer fan, because there's an important game for our Atlanta United coming up later.
Yeah, the playoffs.
Yeah.
That's right. And the Timbers just bombed out of the playoffs, but all right.
I know. Sorry. Oh, and we didn't want to rub it in, but I think we will. Yeah, I'm sorry about last year's final.
Oh, that's right. That's right. You guys beat us 2-0 in the finals. I forgot about that. I kind of wiped it from my memory.
I know. I understand. So tell us your thoughts on being a season ticket holder for a major league soccer team. Like, it's an expensive thing. So what drives you to actually maintain that expense in your life?
Well, for me, it's something that I've been so passionate about for so long. And I just love going to the games. But honestly, more and more, I can't justify the expense. You're right. I did write about this earlier this year. The tickets for 2020, I get two tickets. The combined price is going to be $2,700. I mean, that's $1,350 per seat divided by 17 games. I can't do the math off the top of my head. It's probably $70, $75 a game. But the games cost more than just that. It costs money to get up there. It costs money to park. It costs money if I want to drink craft beer at the game. It costs $10.50 per beer, which is ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. And so my girlfriend and I figure we spend about $200 per game combined, so $100 per person per game, and that's 17 games per season, 17 home games. It's been a splurge that I've been fine with for the Timbers came in 2011, so next year will be the 10th year. I've been fine with it for that 10 years, but more and more I'm like, I don't know, what could I do with roughly $4,000, about $3,500, I guess. I feel like I could do so much more with that money. I mean, I could buy a cable package that let me watch the games, first of all, or I could just, when I wanted to see a game, I could go down to a local pub and drink craft beer and watch the game with other fans. So for 2021, I don't know what I'm going to do.
Well, Hopefully we didn't talk you out of it.
No. I think I've been talking myself out of it for months.
Glad we can kind of share in the fandom there with you. JD, let's talk about money some. We want to start at the beginning, essentially. You've called yourself sort of an accidental personal finance expert. Mm-hmm. Like, what do you mean by that? Can you tell us how you got into nerding out on personal finance information?
Yeah. So when I say that I'm an accidental personal finance expert, I mean that I don't have any sort of formal training in this. I'm not an accountant. I don't have a finance degree. I'm not a certified financial planner. I didn't set out to be somebody who people went to for financial advice. Instead, during the 1990s, I got myself deep in consumer debt with credit cards and car loans and mortgages. And I was really struggling. And so I decided I needed to get out of debt. I started reading all sorts of books like Dave Ramsey's Total Money Makeover and a book called Your Money or Your Life by Vicky Robin and Joe Dominguez. And I read these books and I thought they all kind of said the same thing. They said there's no reliable way to get rich quickly, but there is a reliable way to get rich slowly. And so I kind of took that to heart. And because I was a nerd, I'd been blogging for a number of years already. I always say that I've been blogging since before blog was even a word. I started in 1997. And in 2006, I started a website called getrichslowly.org. And I didn't expect anybody would read it. I was just going to document my own journey out of debt. But for whatever reason, I was in the right place at the right time. And I was able to connect with a lot of people in people liked what I was writing and it was helping other people get out of debt. So over the course of the last 14 years, man, that's crazy. 13 and a half years, let's call it 13 and a half. I've been writing about personal finance, writing about getting out of debt. And then once I was out of debt, I started writing about building wealth.
You know, your story is not terribly dissimilar to so many others in this space, JD, right? We go to a conference every year called FinCon and we meet all sorts of people who became passionate through personal experience more than anything. Mm-hmm. They began mm-hmm. to document their personal experience and then they began to share it. And then it became this kind of thing, this cathartic thing really to help them get through their own money struggles. And then guess what? It ended up helping other people be able to have someone to identify with, be able to kind of learn some lessons along the way. And Get Rich Slowly has been able to do that, but then has gone even further. But when you were going through this process and when you were documenting kind of how you were trying to change your personal finances, well, what were some of the things that were tripping you up the most that made you realize that you needed to make a change?
Oh, that's a great question. There were so many things. I'm a natural born spender. That's the first thing to understand. I'm not somebody who is naturally good with money. I have to force myself to be good with money. And I didn't have good role models in my parents. Both my mom and my dad were spenders. They were spenders in different ways, but they were spenders. And so I didn't have anybody to set a good example for me. I just, when I grew up, I thought if you had money, you spent it. For me, it was just a process with Get Rich Slowly of like telling my story and trying to tell other people's stories about how even if you're not good with money when you start, you can develop better habits. And the thing is, you don't have to be perfect. So much personal finance writing, I think, focuses on this like ideal as if we're robots. And they're like, oh, this is the way you need to do it. And if you don't do it this way, then you're doing it wrong. But that's like an ideal world. And there's so much psychology and emotion involved with it that I think a lot of mainstream personal finance misses that. And so for me, I want to tell my story and tell other people's stories and share not only the things we do right, but how we stumble and how we fall and then how we recover from that.
Well, JD, you mentioned how, right, you were a spender, right? You didn't do great things, you know, with your money, at least at the time. It makes me think back in the day, like how credit card companies, they used to set up a table for signups on, you know, on college campuses. Like specifically, right. I remember signing up for a new credit card and getting a pizza, like right there on the spot.
Wow.
That's the worst signup bonus I've ever heard of, by the way. Especially considering all the great ones out there now. Yeah. A pizza? Come on, man.
Yeah. But JD, do you have a story similar to share? I feel like I've read something about you doing something similar about signing up for a crappy giveaway that you received. Yes.
Well, I never got any good credit card signup bonuses, I wish, but I did something similar with my bank account. So like it was the first day of my freshman year of college. I'm registering for classes in the gym, going around from table to table, looking at the different opportunities. And along with the different departments, they've got like offers from banks and credit card companies. And there were two opportunities to sign up for a bank account. And one bank account, it was the local credit union, and you didn't get anything. It was a free checking account. That was it. It's like, okay, whatever.
Lame.
And I go over to the next table, and it's the big national bank. And if you sign up for a checking account, you get a free Frisbee. Free Frisbee.
The checking account. Do you want to take back your comment about the pizza being like the worst time?
Well, and plus, I had to pay $5 a month for the account. But I didn't, $5, eh. My parents always paid for their checking account. I was like, oh, whatever. I can pay for my checking account too. So I signed up for the checking account, and I'm sure that Frisbee cost them less than $5 back in 1987. So the first month they made back that whatever the Frisbee cost. And I went out and I tossed the Frisbee on the quad a couple of times and then put it away and never used it again. And I had that bank account, it's like 15 years, 16 years, something like that, maybe even 17. So I kept paying that $5 a month fee, and then it was a $7 a month fee, and then it was an $8 a month fee. I just kept paying it for all those years, all because I wanted a free Frisbee that wasn't really free.
So JD, you mentioned kind of getting a plan together, right? Like you reached a point in your life when you were basically tired of missing payments, you were tired of bounced checks. What did that specifically look like for you to put together that plan? And why was that plan so important for you as you moved towards eliminating your debt?
So I don't want to make it sound like the way I did it is the right way. In fact, it's probably only right for me. So I'm laughing because it's kind of a weird TMI type story. I like to take baths, okay? And my then wife and I, we had bought this gigantic clawfoot bathtub. So we both like to take baths. And I was taking a bath and I was reading a book. What was it called? It doesn't matter what it's called. I was reading a money book, and I just got this inspiration. Like, this was 2004 when I was deep, deep in debt. I got this inspiration. I'm like, oh my God, I could do these things and I could get out of debt. So I got out of the bathtub. I didn't even towel off. I went in dripping wet into the dining room table, and I sat down there naked with a pen and paper. There's pen and paper at the table.
All right, that's pretty hardcore.
It is. And I was like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I had been reading Dave Ramsey by then, and I had bought into his version of the debt snowball, which is where you pay the low balances first. There are other versions of the debt snowball, but that's the Dave Ramsey version. When you pay off the low balances first, you're knocking out debts as quickly as possible, just getting rid of the small debts. Anyway, I sat down and I wrote out, okay, what are the balances on my different credit cards? What are the balances on my car loan? How much do I owe my mom? What do I need to do to get out of debt? And so I wrote it all down and I formulated this plan. And this was October 2014. Finally, I got dressed, got my computer, typed it into a text document, not a Microsoft Word document. It was a text document. I did the math and I saw that I could be debt free by December 2017. It was going to be 39 months. And so that text document became my roadmap. And believe it or not, it was exactly to the month, 39 months, it took me to get out of debt from the time I decided to follow that plan.
And so that plan was kind of like your guiding light for every single one of those 39 months, I gather.
Yeah. And the important thing to know is there were times I messed up. There's no doubt. I made some mistakes. And so I had to fall behind. But there were some months where I was like, oh my gosh, I made so much extra this month. I can pay extra on my debts. And so even though I didn't follow it like to the letter, I just, that map was always there. It's kind of like if you're going to, you're driving from Portland to Atlanta and you've got a route mapped out, but you're like, oh, well, I'm supposed to go through Denver, but I'd rather go down through Santa Fe. And so you go down to Santa Fe and then you cut over to New Orleans instead of going through Topeka or something. I still managed to make it work. I got there in 39 months, even though it wasn't exactly the way I had planned it.
Well, I'm not sure why you're avoiding Topeka, JD. It's a great town. Okay, but no, you make a great point, and I think it's really important too because there's a lot of folks, especially like in our Facebook group. So many times people ask the question, like, "Hey, how do I get back on track after, you know, a big snafu, after an unexpected expense that I wasn't, you know, I hadn't planned for. And that can be a really tough thing. And I think having that plan and knowing that you can hop back on or take a different route and still get to that end goal is so helpful, so important. And it's something we have to mention because that's just a common human experience, right? A common money experience for all of us as we're, you know, headed towards that final goal that we're aiming for. All right, we've got so many more questions for JD, including, actually, we don't really talk about politics on the podcast, but JD just recently wrote about politics inside of personal finance, and we have to get to that right after the break. All right, we're back from the break. We're talking with JD Roth. And let's talk some, JD, about your website, your blog. It's called Get Rich Slowly. You know, you just mentioned how you named it. You named it Get Rich Slowly because you're not into getting rich quickly, right? Like there aren't the schemes, you know, like the get rich quick plans. That's not what you're going after. You realize that this is going to be a kind of a long, deliberate process, and you named your site accordingly. I want to talk about how you sold your blog actually at one point for a rather large amount of money. And then you actually ended up buying it back again a few years later. But this leads to a couple questions for you. Not many folks experience like a lump sum windfall like that.
Right.
So do you have any advice for folks who inherit or earn a large sum of money at once?
Yes, yes, yes. That's a great question. So you're right. The irony of running a site called Get Rich Slowly is I got rich quickly from it. And that was never my intention. I did not start out with the idea that, oh, I'm going to make big bucks from this. I didn't even, I knew you could make some spare change from it in 2006. And when I started Get Rich Slowly, I thought, oh, maybe I'll make a little bit of extra income to help me pay off debt. But I wasn't trying to get rich. And in fact, I didn't even believe it was possible until like a month before I sold the site. But I've been getting all these emails saying, hey, do you want to sell the site? Do you want to sell the site? And I'm like, what is this all about? And I finally decided, okay, I will listen to what they have to say. And turns out people were very serious about buying the site. And so I sold it. I got a large lump sum. I would love to reveal how much it was, but I can't because of a non-disclosure agreement.
Oh, you signed one of those NDs.
Yes, but it was a big amount. It was a life-changing amount. And I could have done what many people would do and go out and buy big houses and fancy cars and travel around the world, but I didn't do that. The younger me would have done that. 10 years ago, or 10 years before this was in 2009. In 1999, if I had received a huge windfall, I would have done dumb things with it. But because I had been reading and writing about personal finance, I knew that wasn't wise. So what I did is I said, okay, I'm going to set aside a certain amount. And what I say in public is you should set aside 5%. So if you get a $100,000 windfall, you should use $5,000 to just spend on whatever you want. And in my case, in 2009, you'll remember this is at the bottom of the financial collapse, basically. I decided to buy some very, very nice furniture, which I still have. It was expensive furniture that was discounted 50% or more. I bought a used Mini Cooper because I had been wanting a Mini Cooper. And I took a vacation to Belize, nice. A small country in Central America. That's what I used the money to splurge on. And then I stuck the rest in just mutual funds. And that's where it's remained ever since.
Dang, good time to stash some money in mutual funds, right?
I know. It's amazing.
Well, no, I love that rule of thumb too, 5% to blow, because I think sometimes people trying to get their money act together, if they do receive an inheritance or something like that happens and money falls into their lap out of nowhere, they just have no idea what to do. And some people blow it all and some people don't give themselves any liberty to have some fun with it. And so to be able to take 5 or 10% of that windfall and use it in a way, you know, buy a jet ski or whatever it is that you're into, I think is just a good way to go.
Well, and I want to say that I brought up the furniture and it kind of sounds silly, but this is, it's Stickley furniture. I don't know whether many people know what
this is.
That
sounds like that arts and crafts kind of stuff.
It's a arts and crafts time stuff. It's very fancy. And I love having it in my living room. And every time I go in and I sit down in my Stickley recliner, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is just amazing. And I don't know. It's like this thing that sticks with me and I'm glad that I have it. And I'm glad that I spent that money. So I guess what I'm saying is, yeah, if you get a windfall, use a little bit of it. but try to be like thoughtful about what you're blowing it on. Yeah. What is it that's going to bring you value long term?
Well, JD, and the other thing is too, is that you actually, like, you bought the site back, right? Like you repurchased it. I would love for you to talk some about that. Like why is it that you actually repurchased your own site?
Well, okay. So first of all, this is, well, I've heard of a number of people doing this. They sell their businesses and then they buy them back. In my case, I won't say that it was the smartest financial decision. It was an emotional decision, and I know that. So the people who bought Get Rich Slowly, they did a great job with it for a number of years, but then for whatever reason, it became less of a priority to them, and it started to fall into decline. And I watched it kind of fall into decline, so I contacted them and said, hey, what's going on? Do you have any interest in selling it? And they did, so I bought it back for much less than I had paid for it.
Nice.
And but it was still a sizable amount. And again, I didn't do it as a business decision. I'm glad I did it. I have no regrets, but I did it as an emotional decision because when I sold the site, I sold all the rights to the material that I had produced there. And now by buying it back, I have the rights to use it again. I can do whatever I want with it. And plus I have the brand back. In the interim, it was about 8 years, I think, between the time I sold it and the time I bought it back. I had started another site called Money Boss, and I liked Money Boss. Money Boss was great, but it wasn't the same as Get Rich Slowly. So there you go. I'm happy to have bought it back.
Yeah, that's super interesting. All right. Hey, we said we were going to talk about politics for a second here, JD.
All right, bring it on.
Or at least the politics of personal finance. You took issue recently with an article in the Washington Post that was advocating for more politics. We mentioned earlier the conference that we attend almost every year at FinCon, and it's a great conference full. It's money media folks meeting together. And then you wrote a response to that Washington Post article. Can you share your thoughts on why you thought the author of that article was wrong and why you think kind of politics should be left out of these personal finance discussions?
Well, I don't think they should be left. I don't think politics should be left out of all personal finance discussions. But I think that there's a time and a place for politics. So the article in question was by a woman named Helene Olin for the Washington Post. And she had attended FinCon, and she was disappointed that there wasn't more discussion about politics. And the subtext to the article was that she's actually disappointed that there's not more discussion of liberal politics, which is fine. I'm pretty liberal myself. I get that. But for me, FinCon and conferences like that, they're not a place to talk about politics. They're a place to talk about business. They're a place to talk about personal finance as it applies to everybody. And absolutely, there are elements of politics intertwined with personal finance that cannot be extricated from personal finance. But to get into partisan politics at a place like FinCon, where you've got 2,500 people this year, and you have 2,500 people who are probably pretty evenly divided, liberal and conservative, I think getting into partisan politics at a conference like this is just a recipe for disaster. At this conference, we all get along. FinCon is universally known as a place where people support each other. The people who've been around for a long time are there to help the people who are new. But if you start introducing things that are divisive, like politics or religion or whatever it might be, I think you're very quickly going to descend into what we have in modern American society, where for whatever reason, neither side is willing to listen to and engage intelligently with the other side. It's just crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciated your take on that because I think we see politics invading everything, almost everything in our lives. There's some sort of political bent to it now, and it is just refreshing to be in a space. It's refreshing for us to create a podcast where none of that stuff enters in, because so often, even in the world of personal finance, there's politics inside of it. And so it's good to be able to have a political free space, because it feels like there's almost no place where you can be politically free in this day and age in our country.
Yeah. And the thing of it is, I'm not opposed to people who want to be political, whether they're conservative or liberal. That's all great. But for me, these are very deep, nuanced conversations that require the kind of conversation we're having now, for example, or face-to-face conversation. It's not something you can do over social media in 140 characters. It's not something you can do from the stage or a platform at a conference where you're speaking and nobody else gets to reply. These are conversations to be had with friends and family members, or just small groups at a conference, perhaps, where you can have the nuance and you can listen to somebody who, for example, I'm from Portland. Let's just be clear. I'm from Portland. In Portland, we have a very specific way we think, most of us. And if I'm having a conversation with somebody who disagrees with me, it's going to go much better and we're going to have a much richer conversation if we're able to stop and listen to the other person, if we're able to relate to the person as an individual. And that's very difficult to do through a newspaper column or through Twitter or through Facebook or at a conference like FinCon.
Yeah, a conversation is just so important there. You know, that you can stand up on stage and I think everybody would agree, right? To like the universal truth of compound interest and like how that works. But right. were someone to get up there and talk either for or against universal income, well, like, yeah, that's going to be something that is going to divide folks.
Well, and FinCon has done a good job. I think there's actually been a universal basic income session at FinCon, but right. it was a factual session. It was not like pro or con. It was like, this is what the concept is. And this is how it may or may not work for people.
Yeah, like there's certainly bigger economic problems, right, that personal finance advice can't solve like in and of itself. But like where in your mind, JD, is the dividing line between looking at bigger systemic issues versus taking matters into our own hands?
Oh, that's a great question. So first of all, I want to be very clear. There are absolutely systemic issues that hold people back. And I don't want to pretend that there are not. There are systemic issues that have been around for 150, 100, race is a very real issue in the United States. And it's not a solved problem. Sometimes we want to pretend that it is. It's not. All the same, it doesn't matter what the system is like at this very moment. On an individual level, whoever you are, if you want to improve your life, it is up to you to improve your life. You cannot wait for the system to improve. You cannot wait for the government to implement better policies. You cannot wait for your church to help you out. You have got to take charge of your own life. You've got to say, it's up to me. And then you've got to make the decisions and take action as best you can within the system that you're involved in. Because I know that some people are in places where it's much more difficult to take action. But it doesn't matter. You've got to take what action you can. And if the particular area you're in is screwed up and is especially holding you back, move. For me, I'm all about individual agency, regardless of how bad the overall big picture is.
Yeah, you actually just, it was yesterday maybe, you just recently posted an article about personal agency on your blog, and I thought it was I thought it was really good. We'll link to that article in the show notes. And JD, back in the past, you've written about the stages of financial freedom, and I think that's so helpful too, as someone is able to see what's in their control and then see what the stages look like. I think oftentimes we think about our finances as if we're in one spot, we're either stuck there or we're looking to get somewhere, but we don't see the path along the way. And your article, the way you've been able to talk about the stages of financial freedom have been so helpful to people. And so, can you tell us why thinking about financial freedom in these kind of stages can help people in a way that's like practical and not overwhelming?
Yeah. So nowadays, we're in 2019 right now. I don't know if it'll be 2019 when this comes out or 2020.
It'll be 2019. Don't you worry.
All right. Excellent. So in 2019, the financial independence movement is very popular. And financial independence in most people's minds is the point at which you have enough saved that you could live on your investments for the rest of your life without working if you did not want to. For a lot of people, this seems like an unattainable goal, to have so much saved that you never have to work again. Wow, that's amazing. But here's the thing. I believe financial freedom, financial independence exists along a continuum. It's not just, oh, I'm in debt, or, oh, I have enough saved that I can quit my job and never have to work again. There are all sorts of steps along the way. And I've experienced these steps myself, and that's how I know they exist. So let me give you an example. So I say that if you are in debt and if your lifestyle depends on other people for support, meaning your parents or your spouse or your boyfriend or girlfriend or your credit card company, if you're using other people's monies to finance your lifestyle, you don't have any financial freedom at all. You are essentially a slave. You're a slave to other people because they're the ones supporting your lifestyle. But as soon as you are able to meet your financial commitments without outside help, which means basically that you are earning more than you're spending, or maybe think of it like you're earning a profit, like a business earns a profit. Once you're earning a profit, you've reached the first stage of financial freedom. And it might seem silly, but even just having $5 more than you're spending every month, you're bringing in $5 more than you're spending, even that little amount provides you with some degree of financial freedom. And that $5 more per month will eventually allow you to pay off your debt. So for me, the next stage of financial freedom is actually doing that, paying off your consumer debt, paying off your credit cards, paying off your car loans. Once you have no debt and you're continuing to earn more than you spend, you've reached the next stage of financial freedom. And it's just amazing. It's just liberating. And then the third stage of this financial freedom that I'm talking about, well, some people call it FU money. And this is a concept that has been popularized by Jim Collins, or J.L. Collins NH is how he's known online.
There's a really funny video clip of him.
I think,
right? Talking about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Jim Collins has this, it's the position of FU. I don't remember what it's called. You should link to it in the show notes.
Man, and he's got like the best voice, by the way. He really needs to start a podcast.
Yeah. So FU money is basically, it's just what it sounds like. It's like you have enough saved that you're able to say, you know what? My job sucks. I don't like my boss. F you, I am out of here. And once you've got that much saved, that's another level of financial freedom. And eventually, after you've worked long enough, you've increased your income, you've decreased your spending, you'll have enough saved that you could cover your basic needs for the rest of your life, even if you didn't work again. And it just goes on and on from there. The typical financial independence that we all talk about is supporting your current lifestyle based on how much you have saved. I used to be financially independent. This is something that not a lot of people will talk about. I used to have this financial independence where I had enough saved and invested to support my current standard of living. But because of some poor investment decisions and because of buying back Get Rich Slowly, I'm back to this more basic level where I could, if I were to cut back to just the bare bones, live in a trailer park, eat on rice and beans, I would never have to work again if I didn't want to. But my current standard of living, I have to learn to earn a little bit of extra income on the side.
Yeah, you got to go to those Timbers matches.
Exactly.
Well, I see. That's why I think in 2021, they're out of here.
Yeah. JD, what I love about, you know, what you mentioned there, essentially, you've got these different stages and, you know, you mentioned how it's a continuum. Like, it just breaks it down into these kind of smaller bite-sized steps. It's just more digestible when you're first starting out in your personal finance journey. It's not either, like you said, you're not either in debt, you know, barely living paycheck to paycheck, or, you know, you're financially independent. There's this entire spectrum in between. And I think even just realizing that you're no longer living paycheck to paycheck, and instead, like, you have a little bit of margin in your life, like that,
right?
Like, you're working towards financial independence.
That margin is so important. It's amazing.
Yeah, the $5 is a lot more. I mean, that's such a meaningful step. If you hit that when before you were negative 100, you know, that positive five, that's a big step, and it's something that should be celebrated.
Absolutely.
And I love the continuum thought.
There's a Charles Dickens quote. I'm not going to be able to get it exactly right off the top of my head, but it'll be easy to Google, where he says, basically, if you're earning 5 pounds a year, but you're spending 6 pounds or 5 pounds a month and you're earning 6 pounds a month, the result is misery, even though it's just minus 1 pound per month. But if you're earning 6 pounds a month and you're spending 5 pounds a month, the result is happiness because you're 1 pound a month in the clear. I'm sure you can find the exact quote.
Yeah, it doesn't take much.
No.
So JD, you've also talked a good bit about mental health on your site.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm grateful that we have an opportunity to talk with you about that, and we'll get to that after the break.
All right, we're back from the break. We're talking with JD Roth, who writes at getrichslowly.org. And JD, I so appreciate the honesty that you bring to Get Rich Slowly. You've been really forthcoming in talking about your mental health on the site too. So can you kind of tell us how managing anxiety and depression in your life, because it's something that you've talked about freely and you've dealt with for a long time. Well, how has dealing with that and kind of battling with that really changed your life? And then we'll talk about how it affects money too in a second.
Oh, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure how it's changed my life, because for me, it's been something that has always been a part of my life. I was recently talking with a pair of twins. They were joking. They're like, oh, we always get asked, what's it like to be twins? And they're like, we don't know. What's it like to not be twins? We don't know anything right. else. And so for me, I've always had the depression. I haven't always had the anxiety, but I've always had the depression. And so I don't know life without it. I guess I do, because like right now I'm going through a period of time where I'm not experiencing the depression. I know that for me, it tends to come on March, April, May, June. Those 4 months are just miserable. So I guess I'm kind of lying to you. I'm fibbing to you when I say I don't know what it's like. But it is something that's just always a part of my life. And a lot of times people think depression is like this dark, dark mood, this dark, dark place. And there's elements of that, but it's more like a general numbness. It's just this, you don't care about anything. And that's what sucks, is because, for example, I love the Portland Timbers, or I love Taylor Swift, or I love whiskey and beer. But when I'm depressed, I don't love any of those things. I just don't care. So for me, one of the issues I've had, I think, throughout my life is when I'm going through the depressed stages, I have a tendency to want to spend money to try to like feel something, to feel some pleasure. So I'll, in the spring when I'm going through this, I'll be like, oh my gosh, what can I do? Let me put it this way. My spending on Amazon, if you compare my spending on Amazon in the first half of the year versus the second half, it's like, I'm not joking, it's like 10 times more in the first half of the year than the second half of the year. Because I'm trying to spend, I don't know, because I think that buying is going to make me feel better. It doesn't, but I think it will.
Man, yeah, I appreciate you sharing that, JD.
Yeah.
And I know, right, that you're not alone. I think a lot of people are anxious, in particular when it comes to like their finances as well, right? And so whether it be not making enough money, or you know, if they know maybe that their spending is out of control, or maybe they've got fears associated with investing in the market. Do you have any like recommendations for folks, anything specific for folks to kind of combat that anxiety?
When it comes to investing, or?
Just kind of that general money anxiety. Sometimes it comes out in the form of like, I'm so anxious, I don't know that I can put money in the market. I know that, like, you know, financial wisdom says that it's the right move to make, but I'm too anxious about the possibility of losing 50% of my money. Or, you know, for other people, I mean, it's all these ways that it can play out, these money anxieties.
So there are a couple things to think about here. So first of all, I think it's very important to never make big financial decisions when you're under the sway of strong emotions. And if you're feeling anxious, and I do struggle with the anxiety too, if you have the anxiety and it's active, you should not be making financial decisions. Put them off. It's okay to sit out on the sidelines and say, you know what? I recognize that I'm not in a good place right now. I'm not going to invest. I'm not going to buy a house. I'm not going to buy a car. If you're feeling anxious about it, don't do it. It's okay. But at the same time, it's very important to educate yourself, to seek out reliable sources of information to help alleviate some of this financial anxiety. So using the example of investing can seem very intimidating. And there's what I call the financial industrial complex that has been built up to try to convince you that, oh, you need help, you can't invest on your own, even though you can. There's all this stuff that helps create this anxiety or exacerbate the anxiety. And I think if you educate yourself, read books like J.L. Collins' book, The Simple Path to Wealth, or read Your Money or Your Life, or read Dave Ramsey's The Total Money Makeover. These books will help you see other people who have like succeeded with money, succeeded with getting out of debt, succeeded with investing. And I don't know, for me, with my own anxiety, the reading and like hearing this stuff over and over and over again is very helpful. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. I think, yeah, the reinforcement. And I mean, that's part of the reason that we started this podcast. Matt and I were into talking about money, but it's also this beautiful thing where if we get together twice a week to talk about it and have a beer, it builds us up to do better and to continue going forward, because it's easy to get discouraged and it's easy to kind of fall off the wagon and say, you know what, I'm not going to do that anymore. And that's what we want this podcast space to be for listeners. We want it to be an encouragement. We want it to be a place where people are like, you know what, it's fun, it's lighthearted, it's a great place where I can turn for advice, and they want to keep coming back. And in my mind, that's what your blog is, and that's what we hope this podcast is for people, that it's a place where they can keep coming back and then continue to get reinforced on those good habits, because I completely agree. It's so easy to kind of fall completely off the wagon and forget all about it, you know, and especially after a mistake, right?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yes. The mistakes can be so disheartening. And you hear a lot of times about the similarities between personal finance and fitness. And a lot of people want to poo-poo that and say, oh, that's overblown. It's not really overblown. As somebody who struggles with his physical fitness and who has struggled with finances in the past, I firmly believe there's a great deal of similarity between finance and fitness. And for me, if when I'm trying to lose weight, if I mess up one day, if I go out and I have a burger and fries and a couple of beers, I'm like, oh man, well, you can't just stop worrying about your fitness. That doesn't mean you're done with it. And the same is true with your personal finances. If you go out and I don't know what a splurge would be. You go buy a Nintendo Switch or whatever. Well, that doesn't mean you're like, you should just give up and say, oh, I screwed up this one time, I'm done, I'll never succeed with money. That's not how it works. You made one mistake. Okay, you made that mistake. Time to move on. Continue working toward being better with your money. And it's just important not to let the momentary lapses get you down.
Yeah, JD, what this reminds me of too is kind of going back to earlier when we were talking about politics and personal finance and how we're kind of drawn to the individual nature of it. I think that's a huge reason why we enjoy, why we are drawn to personal finance, is because it's something that kind of comes down to us. Like in the end, it does come down to what are we going to do next? Like what, like, yeah, you know, you messed up, but what's the next step that you are going to take? Because it comes down to you and what you're going to do. And I think that's why personal finance is also like really gratifying and rewarding, you know, from the standpoint of, you know, a writer for, you know, for you, and, you know, we've got the podcast here. That's incredibly gratifying for us to hear from our listeners. And I know you hear from countless readers of your blog that's kept up with you over the years to see how they have, you know, had their lives completely changed and impacted by your writing. And, you know, we're starting to realize that a little bit as well with the podcast. And that's just one of the things that we love about personal finance.
Yeah. And you know, Matt and Joel, one thing I would say, I think one of the reasons that Get Rich Slowly has been so successful over the years is because it focuses on story instead of focusing on facts. The facts are important. The math is important. You can't be successful with money unless you understand the math and the basic financial literacy. But the stories, I think, are what resonate with people, the successes and the failures. And so what you're doing by helping me tell my story, helping other people tell their stories, I think this is so important. And it's something that's missed in the mainstream media, is these stories really can help a wide group of people see what is it really like to manage money successfully and sometimes unsuccessfully, so that you improve your financial situation gradually over time.
Yeah, I mean, anybody can go to the IRS website and see the amount of money you can contribute to an HSA and see its tax advantages. But who does that? Like, who goes to the IRS website and nerds out on that? What they need is a J.D. Roth or a Matt and Joel to help them see how glorious it can be through personal human interaction, right? And so I agree.
Exactly.
There's countless resources out there, but how can you communicate it in a way that's effective and that actually helps people to take action? Because ultimately, it's the action that's going to lead to people changing their lives for the better, especially when it comes to money.
Absolutely. Action is all that matters. I'm such a strong believer in action, not words. I mean, you can talk all you want, but if you don't take action, what does it matter? It doesn't matter what you believe if you're not putting those words into action.
Yeah, I agree. All right, JD, last question for you. We mentioned at the beginning of the show that you are a big Taylor Swift fan.
He's a Swiftie.
He's a Swiftie. And I am a huge Ryan Adams fan until, by the way, all that stuff came out about him and his personal life. That made me really sad. But I've been a big Ryan Adams fan for like my whole life. And so as a big Taylor Swift fan, I have to know, did you like the Ryan Adams cover of her album 1989?
Does this even exist? Oh my God, look, 2015. I'm Googling everybody.
Oh, you don't know about this.
No. Holy moly. Well, I guess I know what I'm doing tonight.
Yeah. All right, get back Holy to us crap. And let us know.
Yeah, wow. It's really good. You ought to check it out.
Wow. I like Ryan Adams too. Wow. Okay, I'm going to check this out. It was released just 3 months after Taylor Swift released her version of 1989. Yeah. So it's like, wow, this is crazy.
I think he was so obsessed with it.
How could he not be? It's one of the greatest albums of all time.
Well, we know you're a true Swiftie. That has been made
awesome.
Clearly apparent. So yeah, we appreciate that, man. And so we really appreciate your time. This has been such an excellent conversation. Thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it. It's been great, Matt and Joel.
Yeah, thanks, JD.
All right, Matt, I really, really enjoyed that conversation with JD. He's been an accidental personal finance expert for a ton of years now, but doling out really, really good financial advice. And so, yeah, that was a great conversation. I want to know, what was your big takeaway from this combo?
Yeah, man, for me, I was glad that we were able to talk about depression. This is something that JD deals with. And so my takeaway essentially is that when you're dealing with depression, right, or if you have some anxiety, it's just really good to remind yourself not only of the truths of personal finance, but of the different stories that are out there of people who have overcome, the folks who are winning, the folks who are doing smart things with their money. I just see that as such a great way to be reminded and to be encouraged when you don't have the brightest outlook when it comes to not just your money, but even your life. And JD has even mentioned how he has turned to consumption in the past, right? To
get Amazon him, specifically.
Yeah, exactly. To get him through those rough patches and how that doesn't work. But in a sense, like, you are consuming when you listen to these stories or you read these books where you know that there are financial truths in those books. It's important to be reminded of those things when you're going through those rough times.
Yeah, I love that he opened up about that. I thought in particular when he said don't make financial decisions while you're dealing with financial anxiety, that was so helpful. Because if you can just put that decision off while you're kind of going through some of that turmoil, it can help you avoid making a really bad decision. Give some time for your mind to clear. That's huge. And I think my big takeaway from this episode, besides that, Matt, was really to beware of free stuff. When someone's trying to give you something free, whether it's a pizza or a Frisbee, oftentimes there are things attached to that. And so you just need to be careful while you're out there, especially when you're dealing with financial products. If someone's offering you something for free, you want to make sure to read the type, read the reviews, see what's kind of going on underneath the hood before you sign on the dotted line and take that credit card or whatever, because there are probably better offers out there. And so, yeah, you just want to be informed before you make a decision based on getting something for free.
Are you saying that to kind of remind yourself when you were kind of going through the different conferences or the different festivals when they've got all the booths set up? I know you love all those freebies.
I like some freebies. I like some tchotchkes from time to time. But if I got to sign my name somewhere in order to get it, I want to make sure that I'm not making an ill-informed, you know, impulsive decision.
Gotcha. There you go, man. Yeah. All right. Well, let's get back to our beer for this episode. We drank Gold, which is a beer by St. Archer Brewing Company. We're thankful for the folks out there for sending this one our way. Joel, what were your thoughts on this beer?
Yeah, we don't drink many lagers on the show, so we are super stoked to get to feature one today.
And this is a light lager.
This is a light lager, which for all the folks that are drinking kind of the macro light lagers, this is just a nice craft alternative to those. And it's not something I typically have in my fridge because I don't care about calories. I care way more about taste personally, but I know other people, they factor in calories to their drinking decisions. But yeah, I thought this was refreshing. It was light. It was just honestly like a perfect lawnmower beer. Like after I'm done mowing the lawn and I want something that I can just take down pretty quickly, but that tastes good, that still has some flavor going on, even though it's kind of light in body, this is the kind of beer I would turn to. So yeah, you would find me drinking this beer like July, August, typically, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. It's not bad to have this time of year though. But yeah, for me, it was a really bright, kind of bright and airy beer. It also had sort of like a light breadiness to it. I think a lot of times when you are drinking a lighter beer like this, like a light lager, you tend to taste, you know, more of like some of the wheatier notes like that versus, you know, some of the hoppier notes, because they don't typically load these kind of beers up with hop flavor.
Yeah.
So it's nice from time to time to switch it up and have a different kind of beer with a different flavor profile like this. I will mention too, it's kind of in one of those tall, skinny cans. And so it's reminiscent of some other, like you said, macro breweries who also pay attention to the amount of calories and carbs in their specific beer.
Yeah. I feel like I'm getting skinnier just by looking at it, honestly. So, all right. Well, Matt, well, that's going to do it for the show today. And if folks want the show notes for this episode, well, you can find those on our website, howtomoney.com. We'll have specific links to some of those Get Rich Slowly resources and some of those articles that we talked about on the show today.
Yeah, Joel, that's right. And if you enjoyed this episode, we would love for you to head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review over there if you have not already. And regardless where you're listening, we would love for you to hit subscribe if you haven't already. That way, you never miss a new episode.
All right, now let's all go listen to that Ryan Adams cover of Taylor Swift's 1989 and just feel good about life.
It's pretty good.
All right, Matt, until next time, best friends out.
Best friends out.
It's only gonna make you love me more.